Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
We start with an unfolding story this morning. Let's have a quote. The combination of overworked staff and aging assets has resulted in the organization being overwhelmed, chronic fatigue for key positions in the agency, lack of resources for training and supervision, and leadership priorities that emphasize meeting capital project demands above passenger operations, preventative maintenance, and even safety. That is strong language from the Federal Transit Administration. Its full report was released literally just minutes ago. Here's Paul Kincaid, Associate Administrator for Communications and Congressional Affairs for the Federal Transit Administration, at a related press conference.
We want today to be the beginning of rebuilding the infrastructure, the culture, and critically, the trust around an important community asset that the people of Massachusetts support with their tax dollars and their ridership. Today can be the beginning of a better safety culture at MBTA.
Joining us now on the line, Congressman Seth Moulton. He represents Massachusetts' 6th District. Congressman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here, Tiziana.
It's great to have you. If you'll forgive me, I just want to lay this out for listeners. So we asked you to come on the show today after comments you made about the Orange Line repair maintenance plan that you had seen. Shortly after that, the FTA announced that it would do its press conference today at 10:30. Last night, the Boston Globe got a leaked copy of the report, put stories out this morning. The MBTA held a press conference in response at 9 o'clock this morning that was embargoed until the FTA released its report, which it did just about 20 minutes ago. So we are going to be talking about some things, but neither you nor I have probably had time to look into the deep details of this, and I want to put that up front. Does that seem fair to you?
That does seem fair. My team got the report last night, so they went through it in detail, but I have not gone through every word myself yet, although I have started reading it.
Nor have I, but I imagine your team gave you the headlines that were most striking for you as a Massachusetts congressperson. So tell me, what is grabbing your attention?
Well, first of all, what I've been saying for a while now is that we need a top-to-bottom organizational change at the MBTA. We need to completely change the culture of the organization, the hiring practices, the way that they carry out operations. And this report completely backs that up. We can't just patch this over, fix the problems on the Orange Line, and pretend we can continue on with business as usual. We need much more drastic changes at the T.
You were dismayed by the fixes that you saw where what the maintenance plan was for the Orange Line for 30 days. Can you just quickly give us the reason behind that dismay?
I mean, they were pathetic. They were just fixing ordinary things that they should repair on a regular basis. They were jumping up and down at replacing 900 feet of rail. To put that in perspective, in the 1860s, Americans laid 10 miles of track per day without any machines. So, I mean, this would be like closing down I-93 for a month so that you could fill potholes and repaint lane lines. This is basic stuff, and yet they couldn't get it done.
So there were more than 50 concerns flagged by the FTA in this final report. Four big categories, as it was summarized by the MBTA itself in the 9 a.m. press conference this morning: staffing, safety management information — that's, you know, collecting and prioritizing safety information — safety communications, and operating conditions, policies, training. That last one, operating conditions, policies, training, that's like running the T. As this is unfolding, that feels consistent with what I'm hearing from you in your concerns about the 30 days, that we have just fallen so far behind on the operations that the level of catch-up feels shocking.
I mean, some of these details are shocking. They make safety decisions not based on data. And that's one of the findings of the report. They have a safety data collection based only on accidents that happen. So they're only going to identify problems after there's an accident. There's no proactive way to identify these issues. They have a culture where safety is considered the sole purvey of the safety department, and everybody else who runs the TU, operates it every single day, has no way to even report safety concerns. in a reasonable manner. So, I mean, these are very fundamental issues. They're hiring practices. They start with mandatory part-time work. I mean, can you imagine applying for a job where they say, if you get this job, we're going to force you to work part-time, even though it's really a full-time job, for the first 2 years? I mean, that's nuts.
I want to pick up on that staffing question. It is one of the key areas. Here is MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak this morning addressing the question of staffing.
The FTA is telling us that we do not have the workforce we need to run the desired, the level of service that we aspire to stay at a level of operating maintenance consistent with the FTA directives and execute the capital plan at the scale and pace that we envision.
So that's MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. We have Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton on the line here as we slowly work our way through, just released this morning, the FTA report on safety and operations at the T. What was striking to me in listening to Poftak this morning, Congressman Moulton, was him saying, step one isn't hiring. Step one is getting us in a position where we can hire at that scale. We still need a staffing plan. Does it feel surprising to you at all, given earlier the 2019 safety report, the earlier recommendations from the FTA back in the spring, that we're still at that place?
I mean, in a way it's surprising, but in a way, I mean, because this is like more shocking than I ever imagined. But, you know, again, this is why we need top to bottom changes at the organization. What's so shocking to me about what Mr. Poftak just said is that it required the Federal Transit Administration to come in and tell them that they didn't have enough people. I mean, that's nuts. I mean, it'd be like if this radio program just went off the air for 10 minutes and you required the Federal Communications Commission to come in and tell NPR that you don't have enough people on staff, as if you couldn't figure that out yourselves.
So
that's how bad this is. It's pathetic.
I'm struck both by a statement from your colleagues in Washington, D.C., in this case, Senators Markey and Warren, and Poftak's response to that. One of the lines in the statement from Warren and Markey said, refers to, quote, mismanagement of Greater Boston's public transit system. Steve Poftak was asked about that comment this morning. Here is his response.
I'm loath to get into a back and forth, particularly with you know, folks who have been elected by the people of the Commonwealth to represent them. I don't view that as my as an appropriate place for me to be in.
What that makes me want to ask you is, as one of those people who has been elected by the people of the Commonwealth, what is the place that you want to be in now with the MBTA in terms of enforcement, follow-up, engagement, et cetera?
Well, Congressman Lynch and Auchincloss and I met with Poftak and his team just yesterday because we said, or I guess it was on Monday, because we're members of the House Transportation Committee. And we made it clear to him that we are going to start getting into the weeds until they can actually give us a way forward. Because what was so shocking about the presentation they gave to us on Monday was not only how rudimentary the safety, the changes, maintenance is that they're conducting, how rudimentary it is, but also how they have absolutely no plan for changing practices so that this doesn't happen again. They did no work to understand how transit systems across the country and around the world are properly managed. So they have no way, no path forward to say, this is what we're going to do differently in the future so we never have to shut down a line for 30 days again. And if we don't make those kinds of changes, everyone in Boston should expect what we're seeing on the Orange Line to happen again in 4 or 5 years, or to happen on other lines even sooner than that.
I want to play a little more sound from MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak in the 9 o'clock press conference this morning.
Of the 53 findings in the report, we do have approximately a third of the findings where we have at least early stage projects underway or foundational projects underway, but roughly half of the findings we will need to plan and implement a response over time.
I'm not trying to be sensationalist in playing that cut and asking you this question, but it is relevant to what you just said. Do you feel there needs to be a change in leadership at the MBTA?
I don't see how you can read this report and not believe that absolutely that has to happen.
And what needs to happen immediately next, Congressman Moulton?
We need to bring in some professionals who know how to run transit systems. Because I ride transit systems around the country and around the world, and it's a totally different experience. You know, you get transit systems like just down in New York, where they're not jumping up and down at replacing 900 feet of track. They're talking about how people are getting to work faster because they're making the trains move more quickly through the tunnels. You go to systems like London, where I went to do some work on the North-South rail link, because they've built 3 cross-city rail links already, while we're still hemming and hawing about getting one started. And their tube, their regular subway, is considered a great place to work. People think it's an innovative company. Have you ever heard anyone talk about the MBTA as innovative? No, they can't simply get people to work without trains catching on fire. I looked at an interesting comparison with Japan's high-speed railways. They have about the same ridership as the MBTA every single year. Since 1964, Japan's high-speed railways, which go 186 miles per hour, have not had a single fatality. Not a single person has died. Their trains go 186 miles per hour. The MBTA is lucky if they get up to 60, a third of that speed.
And I just want to, you know, there's a reference there to the death of a Red Line passenger earlier this year after they got their arm caught in a Red Line train door. Before I let you go, Congressman, you mentioned that you and Congressman Auchincloss and Lynch met with the MBTA at the beginning of the week. This report is unfolding right now. We're all getting our hands around it. Do you have plans to meet with General Manager Poftak in the coming days?
Not in the coming days, but in the coming weeks. The first thing that needs to happen is they need to focus on implementing the changes that have been identified here as quickly as possible. Again, it is shocking that over half of the recommendations from the FTA are catching the MBTA by surprise. And this is basic stuff. This is basic safety procedures that railways and transit systems have been following for over 100 years. And yet the MBTA, the oldest subway in the country, can't seem to figure it out.
Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton represents the 6th District. Congressman, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Tiziana.
We'll bring in another voice now. Jim Aloisi is the former Secretary of Transportation here in the Commonwealth and a board member of the group Transit Matters, which advocates for better, more reliable public transit. Jim, thanks for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
So initial reactions, Jim, I don't know if how much you've had a chance to look through the report again. The FTA just released the hard copy publicly, 45 minutes ago, 30 minutes ago.
I'm playing catch up like everyone else, but I think I've digested enough of it to know that, unfortunately, none of it is a surprise. Many of us, myself included, on your show, Tiziana, and in other forums, have been saying much of this now for the past several years. And what have we been saying? We've been saying that there are two central problems that need to be addressed urgently. One is a funding problem, which means a resources problem. And the second is a governance problem. Let's talk a minute about the funding issue. What the FTA has demonstrated beyond any doubt is that the practices of the current administration, which I would describe as austerity practices, where we're all focused on the shiny object of spending on the capital budget, but there's no attention to the operating side of the house, is a real problem. And just so listeners understand, the transit agency has two budgets, a capital budget, which is the budget using bond funds mostly, that you use to build stuff with. And this administration has increased its capital budget significantly to something like $2 billion. But there's a second budget, which in many ways is as important or more important. And that's the operating budget, which is chronically underfunded, which is about to hit a shortfall wall of over $200 million next year. And that's the budget that you use to pay people with. And what the FTA has said is that the resources to properly manage projects, the resources to properly conduct routine and programmed maintenance for safety purposes. So, those resources don't exist.
Jim, let's hear from Steve Poftak, general manager of the MBTA, this morning in a 9 a.m. press conference on this question of additional resources.
As we go here, if we identify a need for additional resources, I will not hesitate to ask for them. Safety is the priority here. And if we do need additional resources, we will ask. But as it stands right now, we have a significant level of resources available to us.
Okay, context. We're talking about operating. He was listing that there's a $266 million allocation from the Massachusetts state legislature and an additional $200 million allocation that the governor will, in layperson's terms, release later this afternoon. But it is striking to hear him say, if we need additional resources, when you are talking about chronically underfunded operations.
I mean, with all due respect, that's not what he's saying, is just not real. And let me just say, $200 million as a one-off deal, which is all that we're talking about. What the governor's going to do is release $200 million. It sounds like a lot of money. It is. It's a one-shot deal. That's not what you need. What you need is a permanent, annual, sustainable, stable, new revenue source for the operating budget. And so all the legislature has done and all the governor is going to do is give us one-shot deals that will expire and thereby kick the can to the next legislature, kick the can to the next governor. What we need is a permanent, annual, stable new revenue source for the operating budget. And by the way, that $200 million, the T has never taken back its huge mistake that the T board decided to make a year ago, which was to shift $500 million out of its operating budget to do more capital work. The FTA explicitly called that out today. And we've been calling that out, as you know, for over a year as a mistake of the highest magnitude. And so, you know, all that the legislature and the governor are doing, frankly, are making up for that mistake, but they're not being proactive about what happens next.
So you talked about the legislature and the governor there, and earlier you said two key headlines in your mind from this report, funding and governance. We were just talking about funding. Let's talk about governance for a second now.
Sure.
And by the way, listeners, this is Jim Alawisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation, that we are speaking with about the newly released this morning Federal Transit Administration's findings with the MBTA. So here is Paul Kincaid, from the FTA, at the FTA's press conference at 10:30 this morning. Jim, here he is.
There have been decisions made by the T and by the Department of Public Utilities that the FTA does not consider in the interest of safety on the MBTA rail transit system. That is not in any question. And the things that we note in that report are concerns that we have with the decisions that have been made by management and by the operators of the T over a period of time.
And for listeners who may not know, there is some oversight relationship between the Department of Public Utilities and the MBTA as well. Those are oversight questions. We have a new governor, one way or another, coming in the new year. The FTA pushing back hard on oversight decisions that have been made. The FTA even has specific recommendations for the Department of Public Utilities in its 53 findings today. What governance changes have to happen that can happen, Jim?
Well, and so let's again, just to make this clear, folks, the Department of Public Utilities has a safety oversight role over the T that it frankly has abdicated. And that's what the FTA is calling out. But the FTA said something else today. They said, we don't know that it makes sense to have a governance structure where both the MBTA and its oversight agency are reporting to the same individual, namely the governor, right? That's an issue. Hence, what a lot of us have been calling for is a new board structure at the T that empowers more cities and towns, that shifts the balance away from complete gubernatorial control to a mix of say half gubernatorial control, but half municipal control through a larger number of cities and towns represented on the T board.
And as
and
we understand,
the legislature.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What you're about to say next is we understand that the legislature was prepared to do that when the economic development bill fell apart this summer.
Correct. And the legislature really needs to address both the funding issue and the governance issue. This governance structure, this board failed when it transferred $500 million out of the operating budget. And that's the FTA's verdict, not just mine. This board is not working. And in fairness to this board is not apparently capable of dealing with the crisis environment, which is what we're in.
And this is a new board.
This is a new board. This is not the Fiscal Management Control Board that candidly did a much better job at dealing with issues like this. But none of the very few of the legacy issues that the former FMCB board left when it expired have been followed by either T staff or T board. And we're seeing the result of that today. So governance means, I think, changing the structure of the T board to put more cities and towns on it and level it out so that you've got a 50-50 control situation. And then having the DPU staffed properly Department of Public Utilities to do its safety oversight. We need to be able to do two things at the same time in Massachusetts on a transit basis, which is we need to continue to build and modernize the system. We need to continue critical projects like West Station in Alston and the Red-Blue Connector, while at the same time, we're moving forward on basic safety and repair issues. One quick thing I want to say, why is the operating budget so important? It's where you hire people to do the routine maintenance activities that the T hasn't been doing and that the FTA calls out today.
Yeah, and that Congressman Seth Moulton, who was on just before you, called out as well. So this is exactly. Jim Alluisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation. I'm hoping we're going to talk to you again very soon as we all digest more of this. I hope you'll be able to come back.
Anytime you invite me, I'll return.
Thanks, Jim. And I really appreciate you taking the time for us this morning.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We have a teaching shortage in Massachusetts. It is tough to get teachers.
For many districts, it's been a challenge trying to hire enough staff this summer, from bus drivers to teachers. In Worcester, there are still dozens of open jobs listed on the district's website.
And it's tough to keep them.
Superintendents across Massachusetts have said it's tough to retain some teachers following a tough couple years in and out of the classroom during the pandemic.
Sound from Fox 25 there from earlier this week. And if problems hiring and keeping teachers weren't enough, we have another problem in Massachusetts. In 2021, 91% of Massachusetts teachers were white. And in the same year, 42% of students in Massachusetts were young people of color, both data coming from the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. Well, Salem State University wants to close that gap. Nicole Harris is the Associate Dean of the School of Education there. Nicole, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this is a complex problem, yet I'm going to ask you for a 30-second answer to why we are having this problem right now.
Well, this is a really good question, and I think the issue around the reflection of teachers and the students who are in the school districts actually dates back to a historical fact, which is that in 1954, after the Brown v. Board of Education ruling, 38,000 black teachers lost their jobs across the country.
Why?
Because at the time when we started having conversations about integrating schools, as you may know from history, white parents really were not very happy about the fact that black children, for example, were going into integrate schools. Can you imagine their reaction if they had to have black teachers in those schools? And since teachers of color were not considered to be appropriate to be able to teach white students, those folks lost their positions. And here we are a generation or two later, and we're still having this conversation. Nationwide, there's only about 10% teachers of color in the country, and that number has continued to hover around there, as you just mentioned.
And what does the research tell us about the impact of that on students of color?
Well, the fact is that research shows that students of color in the classroom do better when they are working with teachers who are from their own backgrounds.
Who have the same lived experience or similar.
Absolutely. It also shows that those same teachers are bring a culturally supportive teaching approach in the classroom, and they are more sensitive to those students and often have higher expectations of those students' outcomes. And so what we have here is, with a shortage, we don't have enough teachers who are able to offer students that are in the K-12 system that experience. And we also don't have enough folks who are able to reflect what it looks like to be a teacher to these students. And so for them, the possibility that being a teacher doesn't really even enter their minds. So they're, you know, this gets back to representation mattering.
So let's talk about what you're doing about it. And to do that, Nicole Harris, who is the Associate Dean of School of Education at Salem State, I'm going to add another voice. So sit tight for a second. Also here with us, Lorenzo Garcia, who is the Assistant Superintendent of Revere Public Schools. Lorenzo, thank you also to you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us how you are working with Salem State in solving this problem.
So I would go back a little bit and say that Revere Public Schools has made a concerted effort to ensure that we increase teachers of color in our classroom, the so-called BIPOC, middle teachers, which stands
B-I-P-O-C.
Black, Indigenous, and People of Color teachers. As Nicole just pointed out, there is an increasing body of knowledge, you know, of research that indicates that teachers of color has a huge impact in the classroom, particularly in a district where you have up to 70% of our kids are basically kids of color. So just to give you an idea, a study that was done about 4 years ago in 2018 indicates that when a student of color has at least with one teacher of color in a trajectory of 4 year high school, there is compelling, you know, data that shows that they did well in college. The college enrollment
in a traditional 4 year high school, then they do well in college.
Correct. So there is also other evidence that shows that number will actually double if they had at least two teachers of color throughout their trajectory of the high school.
So just two people.
Two teachers of color, you know, throughout that trajectory, actually that number doubled to 32% in terms of enrollment. There is also compelling evidence about attendance. We've been talking a lot about kids not coming to school. Kids need somebody that really believes in them. And also kids, you know, students, you know, need teachers that hold high expectations for them. And the reason there is a strong correlation between teachers of color and kids, students of color, is because the teachers of color have already gone through the same system that really, did not value the experience they bring into the school environment. They know how the system works. The system is very rigid. It's very, it's not really a system that, you know, welcomes, historically, we have got better, but that really welcome people of color or teachers of color. So it's necessary for us to have a role model in the classroom that really kids can look up to, that they can model that behavior and the cultural relevance pedagogy. Also, along with the experience they bring into the classroom, really will motivate kids to stay in school and not drop out of school.
So this is Lorenzo Garcia, who's Assistant Superintendent of the Revere Public Schools, alongside Nicole Harris, who's the Associate Dean of the School of Education at Salem State. We are talking about the shortage of teachers of color in Massachusetts and a project at Salem State to work on that. So Nicole Harris, let me turn back to you. Lorenzo Garcia has just laid out, just in sort of thumpingly unobjectionable terms, right, what the need is. How are you starting to work on it?
Well, I appreciate that question. Very recently, the Cummings Foundation gifted Salem State University a $10 million gift to allow us to rename our school, the McCune School of Education. And part of what we are focused on with these funds is to create an Office of Community Initiatives, which is designed specifically to partner with our districts to meet their needs. Dr. Garcia talked a little bit about the fact that this is about recruitment, this is about retention, and it's about sustaining an already sort of battered field. And so we are creating a number of initiatives to address these issues. One of them is our Educator Scholars of Color program, which we piloted in 2021.
Yeah, this is the one I would really like you to dive into a little.
So the nature of the Educator Scholars of Color program is intended to help close the opportunity gap for students of color who would like to pursue the teacher education, career. And so there's four prongs. One is really about creating community for the students. One is
this
really
is high
about
school students, elementary school students.
It's a great question. These are college students who are currently at Salem State who are coming into Salem State and say, hey, I want to be a teacher. And we know that because the students may not have had a role model, many of them may be first generation college students. Many of them are interested in coming to work through this. There are a lot of barriers and challenges to getting through a teacher preparation program. It's very, very rigorous. Students are required, for example, to be doing field work and being in a school, often uncompensated.
This is while they are in their university studies. They are also unpaid workers in schools.
So they are in there at the beginning, they may be doing more observational work. After time, they need to be engaging with the host teacher and starting to practice. And so Salem State worked to kind of close the gap on some of this by creating a fellowship program whereby during the student teaching phase, students could be employed by a district or receive tuition benefits. And many
schools,
so they
can afford to do it, basically.
By the time they get to the fifth year, that can be and make that possible, exactly. Yeah. But in those early years, students may have to choose between whether they hold a job, which they might need to help their family, or to be able to pay for their tuition or things that they need, and being in a school. There's other pieces, for example, the teacher preparation exam. We give them all those supports. And so part of this is how do we deepen our partnerships with school districts, such as Revere Public Schools, and thinking about how do we help build a pipeline deeper into the high school and then help facilitate a transition for those high school students from the kinds of programs that Dr. Garcia is creating and to Salem State as college students.
So I feel like you're starting to really paint this pipeline for us. So turning back to you, Lorenzo Garcia, Assistant Superintendent at the Revere Public Schools, how is this pipeline reaching into the Revere schools?
So this pipeline is reaching to Revere Public Schools in the following way. The Department of Education is well aware that the current status quo cannot be kept. So what they've been doing technically is basically creating grant programs. Actually, the grant, it's a partnership between the Department of Education and the Revere Public Schools and many other districts. And actually, Governor Baker is basically behind the grant. It's basically putting money out there, asking public schools to apply for grants on diversification of teacher pipeline. So we have applied and we secured a grant, and the Revere Public Schools, fortunately, this year, we were able to work with four different pathways. One has to do with creating your own pipeline. The own pipeline is consisting of kids that we have in our system, yeah.
Which I love.
And actually instill them the love for teaching. And that's what Nicole was talking about. And we have this partnership going on with Salem State. We have about 33 kids or students who have already committed to become teachers.
So then they can follow the pipeline if they choose.
Right.
Exactly.
State.
And then they can come back and give back to the community. The second pipeline is the assigning bonuses. The Department of Education. Signing bonus. We have teachers coming into our district. You write a check and tell them, welcome to our district. We value what you bring. Stay with us because we really need you. The third pipeline is basically the loan forgiveness or loan reimbursement program. How many of our teachers, especially people of color, that go to college that contract this huge amount of loans that cannot be paid? So the Department of Education has put money out there aside for Grab for us to use that money to help and offset the loan that they have contracted with the college. So all these programs and the MTEL preparation program, all these programs combined will make a significant dent in our public schools. And actually, as a result of that, this year, our numbers of BIPOC teachers have gone up to almost 130 teachers, just in 2-year period, just to show you that this work needs to be intentional. It's not just talking about it. It needs to be strategically done in an intentional way.
So as we wrap here, I want to note, and sometimes I tell listeners what they can't see, and the two of you both sound and seem and look so hopeful, Nicole Harris. So 30 seconds or so, you seem so hopeful. What's giving you such hope?
I think that this opportunity that we have before us within McCune School and the community initiatives allows us to be very specific about meeting the needs of the districts in a meaningful way.
In a targeted way.
And this is allowing us to do that. And I think more than anything, the opportunity that we have to allow college students to be role models for high school students in terms of thinking about what it looks like to become a teacher and our ability to expand this program to support them. I feel very excited that we're embarking upon what really needs to happen, which is a longer term sustained effort that over time we can start to undo some of the effects that have occurred over the past generation or two.
Nicole Harris is Associate Dean at the School of Education at Salem State University. Lorenzo Garcia is the Assistant Superintendent of Revere Public Schools. They are collaborating on a really interesting set of projects to improve and change the pipeline of teachers into our Massachusetts public schools. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for inviting us. Thank you.
As I have mentioned, one of the reasons we love our jobs here at Radio Boston is sometimes we just get to have fun. And we are doing that this week. Throughout many years and several hosts on the show, composer Rob Capello has remained a favorite guest. Capello is best known for his What Makes It Great series, where he takes a well-known song or a composer or a genre, and he breaks it down to unpack why certain works have such lasting power. And he does it in this way that's unique and informative and, frankly, just really cool. So as we end the summer and gear up for whatever September holds, we are bringing you three Capello conversations with three different hosts. Yesterday, we heard Rob Capello dissect Mozart's G minor symphony with WBUR's Magnick Chakrabarty. And today, we'll revisit his dive into the work of Lawrence, Massachusetts native Leonard Bernstein with WBUR's Deborah Becker. They spoke back in March of 2018, and they started with Bernstein's love of Beethoven.
You know, Bernstein was always connected to Beethoven, and in fact, he did a whole television show, a famous television show on the Fifth Symphony, where he put the sketches of the Fifth Symphony actually on the stage. And his sort of point was that, you know, we think of this music as just having descended from the heavens, perfectly written. But you look at these Beethoven sketches, it would take him 50 sketches to actually get to what he would call the sort of inevitable perfect version. And, you know, for Mozart, for composers like me, you know, you look at a Mozart score and you want to kill yourself. I mean, there's no mistakes, there's no crossouts, there's no erasures. You feel so much better when you look at a Beethoven score because you see all the agonizing scrawls, the crossouts, and you see that, you know, it got to this incredible version, but the hard work is right there on the actual page itself. And I think that Bernstein was connected to Beethoven. First, he talks a lot about that sense of inevitability in Beethoven, that the story could not be told in another way, that each note follows another note. But I think what really actually got him about Beethoven, as we often see in other people, what's deeply in ourselves, right, was that what Beethoven was really about was about connection, about taking musical ideas that no one would have ever seen as connected before and making them connect. Beethoven's all about looking past the surface differences that seem to separate us. You know, it's no coincidence that when the Berlin Wall came down, it was Beethoven's Ninth Symphony that they played. Alle Menschen werden Brüder. All men shall be brothers. That's what Beethoven is all about. And it's so poignant because there was no human being who was actually worse with other human beings. Right. I mean, he was the worst dinner guest ever. But, you know, deeply there, especially alone, deaf, separate from the world, writing this music about all men shall be brothers, all men shall be connected. And I think that at heart is what made Bernstein so special. Beyond being a great conductor or being a great musician or a pianist, he was about connecting, about taking this music and connecting it to everyone. You know, when Bernstein talks about Beethoven, he talks about his universality, about his ability to connect with anyone, from the most sophisticated to the most uneducated, that his music reaches everyone. And that's what Bernstein's entire life was about. Mm. All the television shows, you know, he once said, if he hadn't been a musician, he would have been a rabbi.
Really?
You know, because I think that's what he was. He was an evangelist for this music. His first instinct when he came to music he loved was to find a way to share it, to get it across, whether it was children's concerts, whether it was the Omnibus television series, whether he was playing, whether he was a musical ambassador. So I think it's connection that moved Beethoven, and it's connection that moved Bernstein to be moved by Beethoven.
Okay. And is that what you love about Bernstein, that feeling of trying to connect?
Well, I think what I love about Bernstein is, first of all, this incredible passionate intensity in everything he did. I mean, you really get this feeling that whether he was conducting a piece of music or playing a piece of music or talking about it, that at that moment, this was the greatest thing ever, that he was sharing with you the most important secret and the most important thing he could. And so I think it's that passionate intensity and conviction, and also the belief that there's only music. In other words, we often make distinctions between classical music, popular music, Broadway music, symphony music. To Bernstein, it was all music. You know, there's a great quote from Duke Ellington. He says, there's only two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. And Bernstein lived that. I mean, he was castigated. You know, now everyone looks back at West Side Story and all the music I'm going to be talking about Friday from Wonderful Town and On the Town as this was great. But when he was in Boston for the opening night of On the Town, Serge Koussevitzky, the conductor of the Boston Symphony and his mentor, spent 3 hours telling him he was wasting his time, throwing away his talents on something as worthless as a Broadway musical. Hmm. But for him, it was all music, whether it was classical music, Broadway music, jazz, piano, it was all music. And I think that's what's so moving, his ability to share all music with anyone.
Now, for your performance, you've singled out one of Bernstein's early works, Wonderful Town.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the goal for this program is really to put Bernstein's achievement in a way, in a kind of context. Everybody thinks of West Side Story, the greatest thing ever, you know, landmark musical of 1957. But I wanted to try to put it in context, both of his earlier music, because people don't know his earlier music, On the Town and Wonderful Town, but then also in the context of the other great theater music of the time. So I start the show with this song, A Little Bit in Love, from Wonderful Town, which is 1953, only 4 years before West Side Story. And that's what we begin with.
Hmm. Okay, we do have a recording of A Little Bit in Love, a 1999 recording of A Little Bit in Love from Wonderful Town. And this is sung by Audra McDonald. Let's listen.
I'm a little bit in love. Never felt this way before. Just a little bit in love, or perhaps a little bit more.
So tell us about this.
Doesn't the whole mood of the entire station just change when you listen to this music?
It's great. It's really...
And remember,
it's different.
Remember, this is the Bernstein who was conducting Mahler symphonies. This is the Bernstein who wrote his Jeremiah symphony. But it's just this incredibly relaxed music. It's Bernstein with this incredible love, facility, and affection for the Broadway popular music of his time. Stepping out of his white tie and tails from the New York Philharmonic and swinging. You know, just take that opening phrase. You know, this little phrase. Now, I mean, first of all, if he had done classical rhythm, if he had been at the New York Philharmonic, it would have had square rhythm, bum, 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 like this. I'm a little bit in love. But there's this wonderful slide on the very first note. He goes, that little slide. I mean, that's Bernstein, the conductor of the New York Philharmonic. That is what it feels like to be a little bit in love. And then that swing rhythm instead of this. It just swings easy. And I'm just a little bit in. And that wonderful rhythm, a little bit in love, that little syncopation brings it to life.
That's beautiful.
And you know, I mean, just one more thing that I can't resist. The next phrase, never felt this way before. You know, if you played that left hand alone, you might recognize it. It's the same left hand as Heart and Soul.
This
is Bernstein loving
never
the world of popular music,
before.
Facility and affection. That's where he started as a composer.
So put him just in a little bit of context for us here in terms of Broadway shows at the time. What, you know, what was going on here?
Yeah, as I say, this was the music of the time. This fit in perfectly to the shows that were going on. But 57 is when he wrote West Side Story. 56. The Tony Award-winning musical was actually My Fair Lady, and I Could Have Danced All Night, which we'll actually compare to tonight in our actual show. So the year before, the Tony Award-winning musical was My Fair Lady, but the year of West Side Story, amazingly enough, Music Man beat out West Side Story for Best Musical of 1957, which is really astonishing.
Hmm. Can we have to make sure that we get the West Side Story ballad in here, because,
okay.
Sheesh, if we didn't do that, we'd be in big trouble. So we do have a recording of it, of Somewhere, from the 1957 original Broadway cast of West Side Story. Mm-hmm. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
Okay. So here,
That's what we all know from West Side
What
Story.
An amazing beginning if you actually think about it. First of all, the whole idea of a musical that's a tragedy. I mean, musicals are supposed to have happy endings. Mm. I mean, here is one in which the three main characters are killed off. In fact, producers were unwilling to actually invest in the show because they thought it was such a downer. I mean, it's Romeo and Juliet, but it's a tragedy. But even that beginning, I mean, first of all, she starts off with just by herself, two notes. That leap, by the way, is the only leap of a minor seventh that I know, maybe somebody will call and tell me I'm wrong, of any opening popular song. You know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow starts with an octave leap. That's a big leap, very rare. And in fact, producers thought that song would never be a success because it's too hard to sing an octave. But this is even worse. It's a minor seventh, the hardest interval to sing, and it's unaccompanied with no help. I don't know of any other piece that begins with that. But not only that, that little leap becomes the entire accompaniment. Every measure of the accompaniment has a leap of a seventh. It almost sounds like Schoenberg if you play it by itself. I mean, this is a classical composer in the Broadway world, taking an idea, a simple opening leap, and making the whole accompaniment out of it, but it's a single line. There's no full orchestra. It starts from nothing. There's only two parts, a voice, an accompaniment of only one line. Just one line. Then, all of a sudden, you rise. Peace and quiet, and you rise to the open air, that simple scale. Suddenly you're in the open air, you take open air, you do it higher. Anyone else would have finished and we would have been done, but not him. They are not there yet. This is the some place they'll never actually get to. So you're thinking, it's open air, that's what I'm looking for. You try it higher, wait for us, but resignedly, unfortunately, no. Somewhere, down there. But then later he will take the one that goes down somewhere, we're not there, and in the middle it will go up someday with hope. What goes down becomes someday. The same melody note, change the chord underneath, becomes deeper and more emotional. Somewhere. Then to the highest note of the piece, he'll find a way, a new way of living. Take that same melody, do it lower for forgiving, and then put in a beautiful forgiving chord. That chord is all the forgiving that we wish we could all reach to, and then back to somewhere. And then the beautiful ending of the song. So we've had someday, same note twice. Then we went in the middle to we'll find. But this last time we do it three times. Same notes, change the chord, everyone expects, but instead we do it a third time, and the two ideas of the piece meet, somewhere, and there's a place for us in the accompaniment. They happen at the same time. And then we meet on the key rhythm of the whole song. They may never meet together, but the melody and the accompaniment have found they're somewhere.
That was musician, composer, and author Rob Capello talking about the musical greatness of Lawrence, Massachusetts native Leonard Bernstein with WBUR's Deborah Becker back in March of 2018. He was in town that year at that time to break down the music of Bernstein at the Sanders Theater as part of the Celebrity Series of Boston. Tomorrow we'll bring you one more conversation with Capello, this time on Beethoven. And let's go out today with Rita Moreno performing Somewhere from the 2021 film version of West Side Story.
Someday, so